Oh.
They can have my mortgage, you know. They can take over my mortgage.
Well,
did you?
Yeah.
So Charlie, I'll talk to you.
Okay, yeah, no, it's called, I think Amanda's going to be late because she's in Salem, so start with my button there. Okay, you ready, Carla? Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the April 3rd meeting of the Portland City Council. Carla, would you please call the roll?
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Novick?
Here.
Fritz? Hales?
Here. Commissioner Fritz is in Salem on behalf of the city and will be joining us late for this council meeting. So let's begin with communications items, number 279.
Request of John Kerry to address council regarding Aurochs Leather Company and PDC's work with small businesses.
Morning, Mr. Kerry. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Secretary, it's an honor to have you here.
Well, thank you.
That is so interesting. I always have an enjoyable time with my name, especially during the elections here a few years ago. So,
welcome. Well, you just have to put your name in the record, and you have 3 minutes, so welcome.
Great. Thank you very much. My name is John Kerry, and as you mentioned, I'm with Aurochs Leather Company, and I'm the chief financial officer for that company. Aurochs Leather is a small business that makes and sells quality handmade leather goods in the city of Portland. Our products include sandals, handbags, purses, wallets, backpacks, belts, and other accessories. These products fit well with the lifestyles of Portland residents and visitors, which is an important reason that we are located right here in this city. Aurochs Leather currently employs 4 people who live in North Portland, and we buy services from 3 people who live in various areas of Portland, and then we buy raw materials from 5 companies, which are located in Portland. Each of these people and companies pay income taxes and property taxes, business license fees. And I'd like to point out that by providing employment to our workers, we give them a chance to own homes, to raise kids, and to make a contribution to the community. Aurochs Leather strives to carry out sustainable practice in all of its business practices, in all of our operations. So after recently completing an MBA in sustainable business at Merrillhurst University, I worked with my partners at Aurochs to integrate sustainability into our material sourcing, our production practices, and other areas without compromising our company's bottom line. For example, we use recycled scrap rubber for the soles of our sandals, and we use recycled bicycle tubes for some of our products, both of which would otherwise end up in landfill facilities if we didn't put them to productive use. And we think our practices in this area are very consistent with the City of Portland's planning and sustainability goals. Aurochs Leather has grown up in Portland from a household operation which sold primarily at the Portland Saturday Market to a company with its own retail store in Old Town Chinatown. We also have internet sales, and we sell in wholesale markets in several states and internationally. I wish to acknowledge the Portland Development Commission, who has been instrumental in helping us both locate the building that would serve us well for our combined production facility and retail store, and to provide a very much needed matching grant and architectural design assistance for our storefront improvements. Without PDC's support, I doubt we'd have our own retail store and the improved production floor that we have today. And without the retail space and larger production facility capability, I doubt that our business would be on its growth path with projections for hiring more employees in the not-too-distant future. I'd like to wrap up my comments today by saying that I fully understand that the city is faced with budget deficits, and I understand. However, Orox Leather Company, the athletic and outdoor industry, and the City of Portland need the Portland Development Commission to remain active in economic development. The net result is more jobs, more revenues, and greater livability for the great city of Portland. I want to thank you for your support of the PDC.
Thanks very much for coming. We don't often hear from small business people because it's hard to get away, so we especially appreciate you taking time to come here and give us this case study of how it's working for you. Thank you.
You're most welcome. It's a priority for us.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. Item 280, request of Mary Eng to address council regarding Jonas Fikre and FBI Mohammed details.
Good morning.
Good morning, Council. I would like to introduce Attorney Tom Nelson for Jonas Fikre.
How are you? Thank you. I bring greetings today from Mr. Fikre. Fikre,
you're taking Mary's time. Is that how it's working?
I would like you to enjoy some of his testimony regarding Jonas Fikre. I could summarize towards the end.
So 3 minutes, please.
Thanks. Very good. Thank you. I'm Thomas Nelson. I'm an attorney. I live in Zigzag, Oregon. I'm bringing greetings today from Jonas Fikre, who is an American citizen, resident of Portland, and he is not in Portland because he can't come back to Portland. I'd like to tell you a little bit about his ordeal and why I think it's important. He is basically right now stateless. He was born in Eritrea, but he was born in Eritrea before Eritrea is a country, so he's not a citizen of that state. He has no rights as an Eritrean. He has no rights as a citizen of anywhere in the world except the United States, where he was a naturalized citizen. Mr. Fikre's ordeal, he's about a 30-year-old man. In April of 2010, he was in the Sudan trying to set up a business, and he was asked to come to the American embassy and told that it was for his own safety because there were some problems involving security there. And he went to the embassy, and instead of being met by embassy personnel, he was met by two Portland FBI agents who told him that, as a matter of fact, they wanted to talk to him, and he said, well, I want an attorney in that case. At that point, Mr. Fikre was being represented by Brandon Mayfield, whom you may have heard of. They told him, no, you can't have an attorney because your attorney is in the United States, and here you are in Sudan, and we have to talk to you. So they talked to him, and he, notwithstanding his request for an attorney, engaged in a discussion for several hours, during which time they asked him about, what are you doing in Portland? What's going on in Portland? All about Portland. What's going on at the mosque? Who do you know there? What's going on? That kind of thing. But toward the end, they said, we want you to work for us for pay, for substantial pay, as an informant. Will you do that? And he said, I don't think so. I'm really not interested in that. They said, well, let's meet tomorrow and talk about it some more. He said, let's meet tomorrow. He agreed. Then he left. After that, he was picked up. He left Sudan, went to the UAE, and about a year and a half later, he was picked up by the UAE secret police and held incommunicado for 106 days, tortured. Same questions. What's going on in Portland? What are you doing? The embassy asked, well, why are you holding him? The UAE said, he's not being charged with anything. We just have an investigation. When the investigation was complete, they released him, but then he went to get him a ticket home, and they said, no, you can't go back to the United States. You're on the no-fly list. He had no alternative but to find another country immediately. He chose Sweden because he has a very distant relative there. He went to Sweden. He went to Sweden, and being stateless, not wanting to remain same, he applied for political asylum. I believe, that Mr. Fikre was tortured at the request of the Portland FBI in order to see what's going on in Portland. My question that I want to leave you with is, what do you think about this? What would you do if you were overseas and your government said you can't come home? You can't fly home, and by the way, that also means you can't take a boat home. What would you do? More importantly, I think it might be a reason for you to inquire further into whether it's a good idea, or at least get more facts relating to how the Portland FBI office treats its Muslim American citizens. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much, Council.
Appreciate it.
Item 281, request of Ann Eng to address Council regarding fluoridation's interference with iodine.
Morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm Mary's mother, and one of the things she said at, and my name is Ann Eng, and one of the things she said in one of her previous appearances here kind of touched off something that has been very dear to my heart. I'm a registered nurse and have been practicing for 38 years as a registered nurse, and 7 or 8 years before that as a nurse's aide. So I've been enmeshed in the medical world. I've worked in many capacities. Here in Portland, I've worked in the Veterans Administration, which is where I currently work in the psychiatric unit with returned veterans. I also have worked at, in Corrections Health here, downtown here and out at Inverness. So I feel like an Oregonian. I was raised in this community, lived in Nashville, Tennessee for 30 years, so I actually have lived in different places. What is dear to my heart is something that Mary said, and it was something about the use of fluoride. Now, I'm not here to lambast fluoride. I think it lambasts itself if you get the information about it, and it's the fact of what it does, the fact that it crosses the blood-brain barrier and causes dementia in people. I don't think any of us want dementia, but if we're going to be immersed in fluoridated water, we might go the way that the rest of the nation is going with the increase in that. My real point is that we can combat the effects of the fluoride if we do something else, which is kind of, it's just beginning to be realized that our real deficiency is that we don't have iodine in our systems. As a nurse, this is very important to me because I see people with fibromyalgia, autism, the whole spectrum of dementia type disorders, every kind of cancer. For instance, women, 1 in 7 women will have breast cancer. That's an immense rise as the incidence of iodine in our soils and in our diets has decreased in the last 30 years. The incidence of breast cancer has increased. And the there's 4 gentlemen up there. One of you will have prostate cancer, okay, and may die from it. And if you don't die from it, you might wish you had because it interferes with your personal life, which is very embarrassing for you. I think, you know, it's very nice to talk about the effect of fluoride on teeth, but I think I would rather have bad teeth than cancer. And not that I'm advocating having bad teeth because I'm not, but there are ways to administer. If we have to administer fluoride, we should do it topically to the teeth. We shouldn't all be drinking it carte blanche, where all of us are subject to any of the diseases. I mean, I have a list of, maybe 15 or 20 diseases right here that are prevalent and more prevalent because of the decrease in iodine. And it's proven statistically. I have a really interesting book, which is in its fourth printing. It's called Iodine, Why You Need It and Why You Can't Live Without It by Dr. David Brownstein, who is a certified board-certified medical doctor, as well as has been interested in the effect of nutrients on our system. And I think it would be good for you to go on the Internet and pull it up and read about it to protect yourselves because you don't want good teeth and cancer. I'd rather have bad teeth and no cancer. Okay, I've been subjected to a lot of the effects of iodine deficiency. For instance, my husband has had Guillain-Barré syndrome, is currently suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease and dementia. Okay, these probably could have been prevented if the iodine had been produced in our bodies. I've had multiple cysts in my body. I just got out of surgery a month ago, having a cyst this big, as big as a golf ball, on one of my ovaries. The cysts are caused because the body's straining to be healthy and in its process can't find the iodine. So when we replace iodine and fluoride, among other things, I'm not just pointing my finger at fluoride, but iodine and fluoride are companions or halides. If you get out your periodic table, you'll see it. And they if you don't have enough iodine in your system, fluoride will take the place. And it eventually makes the enzyme system that prevents cancer from effectively working.
Well, thank you. No, I appreciate you bringing this to our attention. Thanks for coming.
Okay. And Iodorol is available online. I wouldn't medicate myself, but I would draw to your doctor's attention that you can get more iodine without having to eat sushi.
Thank you. Thanks for coming.
282, request of Melissa Henderson to address council regarding water fluoridation.
Henderson, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. I'm here representing the
Just put Native. Put your name in the record.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes. My name is Melissa Henderson, and I'm with the Native American Youth and Family Center here in Portland, Oregon. And I'm here to testify on both our organization as well as my personal support for fluoride. At NAIA, I'm what's known as a health navigator for the Native American community. My job is to help community members that are enrolled, not enrolled, identify health and dental resources, and then practice using those resources. And while a lot of my job does focus on prevention, you know, establishing a medical home, nutrition, physical activity, there are some things that are just you can't control. You know, the behaviors are a little harder to modify, or it's just not within people's means. Our community is disproportionately poor, homeless, unstable, in foster care and treatment. And so for a lot of them, the routine of going to school to get the fluoride treatments, establishing a dentist, is just not a reality. And so at NAIA, we see water fluoridation as a really effective preventative solution to keep the dental caries from actually occurring. The city's been great in helping us establish 2 Head Start classrooms for the Native community, and our community loves it. But a lot of the time, by the time our kids are getting to Head Start, they already have extreme deterioration on their teeth. They're going through pain, suffering. Parents don't know what to do. In my day-to-day, say I see 10 people in a week, 9 of those people are begging for dental care. It's just not something that's readily available. And we see fluoride as a really great way that we can, you know, prevent that from happening. It might not help the adults and elders that are suffering now, but it would help the 7th generation or the next generation that's coming up. In my written testimony, I provide some statistics that I'm sure you guys have already heard. More than 70% of 6 to 8-year-old Native Americans have untreated cavities. Native preschoolers are 5 times more likely to have tooth decay than any other racial and ethnic group. And these aren't just statistics. This is what we're seeing. And so I ask for your support in passing fluoridation for the city. Thank you for your time.
Thanks for coming. Thank you.
283, request of Jamal Lane to address council regarding Champions Barbershop and the Micro Enterprise Services of Oregon.
Good morning. Welcome, Mr. Lane.
Good morning. Thank you. Like she said, my name is Jamal Lane. I'm representing Champions Barbershop. On behalf of my affiliation with MISO, the Micro Enterprise Support Services Organization, and I just wanted to, you know, testify to the fact that this organization has been a great help to me and my pursuit of expanding my business. My first shop is on Martin Luther King and Phelan, and MISO is right up the street on Martin Luther King. And so I was informed about this organization and their, ability to help businesses in a lot of different ways. And so when I approached MISO, they offer me a lot of different opportunities for education as far as business goes, loan services, different types of software and things like that to help put my business in order. And so after dealing with them for a while, they were able to help me get a loan to expand. So just recently, it's been 6 months now, I was able to open up a second shop out in Beaverton, Oregon, and it's been going well. And they stayed with me through the whole process. The loan process was really good. They actually helped me step by step in getting that together, all the paperwork and things like that. So, I just wanted to, if people didn't already know about MISO, I wanted to say that it was a great experience to work with them. It's a great grassroots type of organization. And being that they're right on the, you know, right in the neighborhood that I'm in, it was good to see them actually follow through with the things that they say they offer. Because I ran into a couple of different situations where people say they offer small businesses opportunities. But for some reason or another, those opportunities never come to pass. So MISO has definitely lived up to what they say they are about. And I just, you know, advise anybody, you know, if there's anybody in here that's looking for that type of support, to look at MISO as that means of support. So, yeah, that's my testimony.
Great. Thanks for coming. Yeah, we really depend on small business in Portland, so we appreciate hearing about what's working and not working for you and other small businesses.
Yeah, MISO definitely worked for me.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Thanks.
Thank you all. Okay, we have consent calendar. I believe we have one item that's been pulled from the consent calendar already, which is item
290.
Thank you. Anything else to be pulled from the consent calendar? If not, let's take a roll call on consent.
Fish.
Aye.
Saltzman.
Aye.
Novick.
Aye.
Hales.
Aye. Time's certain.
Do you want to read both items or just one?
Let's do the two together, please.
Okay. 284, proclaim April 2013 to be celebrated as Arbor Month in the City of Portland. And 285, approve the designation of 3 trees as City of Portland Heritage Trees.
And we have Parks Bureau staff and commission members here, I believe, to present on this morning. So welcome. Come on up. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor. I'm Michael McCloskey. I'm a member of the Urban Forestry Commission, the person who's chairs their Heritage Tree Committee, and I have a set of proposals to lay before you today. They were approved by the commission at its meeting on February 21st. The three candidates for Heritage Tree designation that we have to propose today are a dawn redwood, a pin oak, and a European beech. One is on holdings of the Hoyt Arboretum, and two are on private property. All of them were nominated by their owners or managers. The consent forms have been signed. One of these trees is in southwest Portland, one is in northwest Portland, and one is in North Portland. The first tree that we propose be designated is a dawn redwood on southwest Bray Lane in Hoyt Arboretum. It's near the end of a stub road. It has had some competing trees cleared away so that it stands by itself in a singular fashion. While trees of this type are not uncommon in our system, actually 4 designations have been made by you, and all of these trees date from about the same time, that is about 1948, this would be the tallest in our system. It is now 103 feet high. Its circumference is one of the larger at 10.6 feet. It has begun to assume a more mature form and shape, and it's easy to observe from the road. It has already been designated as a state heritage tree under their program. It was recognized as being the first of its species to set cones in the United States since the extinction of this species in North America. Hoyt Arboretum officials believe that Portland should join the state in recognizing this specimen by adding it to our system. We believe it should be designated because of its size, its type, and its history. As to history, the seeds were brought over from China in 1947 after having been discovered a few years before. It had been thought to be extinct. It is one of the few species of deciduous conifers. If you do designate it, we hope that Hoyt can make it easier for visitors to find it. It's an obscure location, but that can be easily done. Now I will move to our next candidate, which is a pin oak. It's in the Northwest Hills at 1611 Northwest 32nd Avenue. It was nominated by its owner. It's an old tree, having been planted in 1903. Some of its branches are braced with cables, having been damaged in various storms. Nonetheless, it is still growing vigorously and has a quite adequate crown. It's located in the corner of a front yard. It's quite visible from the two adjoining streets which intersect at that property. At the present time, we have only one other pin oak in our system. It's in southeast Portland. This specimen that we're proposing here exceeds its dimensions in two respects. It's taller at 115 feet of height, in contrast to only 60 feet for the other one, and in terms of its circumference, 12.4 inches in contrast to 11.5. All who looked at it agreed that it was most impressive and deserves to be in our system because of its age, size, and type. We felt that we can use more suitable specimens of this species in our system. The third tree we propose designating is the European beech, which is located at 4073 North Gantenbein Street. This tree is in the front yard of this property. It's easily observed. While we already have 10 of this type of tree in our system, this specimen has a crown spread that exceeds that of all the trees of this type now in our system. Its circumference is also in the middle of the range of the trees of this type in our system. We felt that it merits designation because of its size. It is also a tree that is admirable for various reasons, its beauty and the various ecological services it provides. It is a very impressive specimen. And those are our proposals, and we invite your consideration.
Mike, could you just give us the nickel description of what a heritage tree is, so those who are listening and watching can, and might have trees they want to nominate would...
We certainly welcome nominations. You may wonder why we sometimes bring new leading trees to your attention when we already have some. It's because they haven't been nominated up until that point, or we haven't even discovered them. Your ordinance declared that these are trees that are of special importance to the city of Portland by virtue of their various attributes, size, age, type, historical associations, or their horticultural type. Indeed, we have one of the most robust systems in the country, and I think a more sophisticated system of recognizing the attributes that command make them of special importance to us.
So if people have outstanding trees that they want to nominate, they can contact the Urban Forestry Commission? Is that
absolutely, and there are forms online, and we go out a number of times a year and look at them, and your arborists investigate them, and they're thoroughly scrutinized.
Thank you. Thanks for your outstanding work.
Yeah, thank you very
Michael,
much.
Michael, I just have a question. You've given us a report this year that has all the trees in it and other information. If someone in the public wants to know what are our heritage trees and where to find them, I understand they can go on the website as well.
Everything's online, and it's very impressive there, but some of us are just delighted to finally have another hard copy version, which is new and improved. My colleague here, the staff botanical specialist, Angie DeSalvo, took the lead in preparing this, and so I'm glad you are recognizing
it. Terrific work, but I also see, since we have Jen Cairo here, I assume that if you just go to the Portland Parks and Rec website, there's a tab under urban forestry where you can get all the heritage tree designations. Thanks for your good work.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Mike. Thanks very much. Other commission members or staff that want to mention anything on these two items? Is there anyone signed up to testify?
Yes, we have two people, Brian Birch and John Carey.
Welcome. I think Mr. Carey may have been signed up for the other items. Welcome, Mr. Birch.
Good morning. My name is Brian Birch. I am on the Urban Forestry Commission Education and Outreach Committee. And following up what Michael has just said, I wanted to make sure the council is aware of the Treasure Map, which is on the opposite side of the Arbor Day Festival, actually Arbor Month Festival. As you probably already know, Portland often celebrates Arbor Day, has for the last 36 years and beyond, has been Arbor Week for many years, and this year we're doing a first, Arbor Month. I wanted to particularly compliment city staff in the assistance that they continue to give and have always given volunteers like myself and others on the Urban Forestry Commission. Without city staff offering the kind of support that they do, we would not be effective in our volunteering. The Tree Steward Coalition, which is one of the major outputs of the Urban Forestry Commission's Education and Outreach Committee, is very active. We had many graduates, I think around 30 graduates this last year in 2012, and it's those people who create the core group who encourage other volunteers and encourage people to take the lead in projects just like this, turning Arbor Day into Arbor Month, giving Portland a reason to celebrate trees 30 days every single day of April. I appreciate your consideration when it comes to budget time in remembering how city staff is a valuable asset to volunteers like myself. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for what you're doing.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Great. Well, before we take a roll call, let me read the resolution because it's got some great material in it, and it helps highlight what we're about here with Arbor Month. Whereas schoolchildren in the United States began celebrating Arbor Day in 1882, and Oregon recognizes Arbor Week as the first full week in April. And whereas National Arbor Day has been observed on the last Friday of April since 1970, and it's estimated that more than 18 million trees will be planted on that one day, and whereas for the 36th year, Portland has been recognized by the National Arbor Day Foundation with a Tree City USA Award, and whereas a study by American Forests released in 2013 named Portland as one of the 10 best U.S. cities for urban forests, and whereas Portland Parks and Recreation recognizes the connection between urban forests and a healthy environment and has been recertified as the only salmon-safe park system in the country, and whereas Friends of Trees has planted 500,000 trees and native plants since being founded in 1989 and now in partnership with the Portland Timbers Major League Soccer team celebrates each scored goal by planting a tree, and whereas the Portland Farmers Market has been bringing the best of the country to the heart of the city since 1992 and invites everyone to an Arbor Day festival at the PSU South Park Blocks Farmers Market on April 20th, and whereas the Portland Heritage Tree Program has honored over 300 trees and is inviting everyone to celebrate the dedication of the city's first heritage tree at Hoyt Arboretum on April 30th, and whereas the community volunteers, staff, and partner organizations work year-round to enhance our urban forest by planting, maintaining, and advocating for our 240,000 street trees, 1.2 million park trees, and countless private trees, now, therefore, be it resolved that I, Charlie Hales, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, do hereby proclaim April 2013 to be Arbor Month in Portland, Oregon. That's our resolution. Let's take a roll call and hear council comments.
Fish?
Mayor, this is one of the happiest forums that we host annually when we welcome new trees into the Hall of Fame, if you will. And we also get to look at the, I guess it's the Latin derivative for these trees, which I'm going to challenge Michael McCluskey in one of his presentations to actually go by the Metasequoia glyptostroboides rather than the Dawn Redwood. But I would hate to have that thrown at me at a spelling bee. There's lots of people to thank. I want to start with Michael, because he's been our champion for a long time doing this work, and he's a very modest man. He never actually gets up and reminds us about the distinguished career he's had in advocacy and in groups and different roles, but we're very honored to have him at the helm. I also, on page one of our of this brochure, it lists the staff and the tree committee members, and special thank you to the Bureau staff who've worked so hard under Jen's supervision, and that's Angie DeSalvo, Josh Darling, Autumn Montegna, and the other members of the Parks team who've worked on this, and obviously the Urban Forestry Commissioners and the citizen volunteers. Thank you for your great work. And today we welcome the Dawn Redwood, Pin Oak, and European Beech to this special category, and it's a pleasure to be able to support your good work. Aye.
Saltzman?
Well, I very much appreciate the work of the Heritage Tree Committee. I'm a big fan of heritage trees. You know, one time I said in this room something about trees have rights and was soundly criticized by some conservative talk show radio host for saying that. But these trees, the ones that we provide, the private owners step up and say, we want this tree protected, and we're willing to, you know, change our property deed to reflect that. These trees really do have rights. And these 300 or so trees in the city of Portland, by virtue of their size, their age, their outstanding attributes, really do add to the urban context and urban fabric and really do enjoy special rights. And, you know, I'm proud to say that once again. And thank you for all your work. Keep up the good work. I look forward to our next round of nominations. This is my favorite activity. Aye.
Novick?
Well, I hate to rain on everybody's parade, but I, for one, think it's high time to root out the corruption that's been rotting the heart of this so-called heritage tree process. Sure, the pin oak at 1611 Northwest 32nd Avenue has friends in high places, but I, for one, cannot overlook its shady past, especially when there are worthy trees like the hemlock at 5202 Southeast Oak that has been laboring in obscurity, but a proper Portlander from bark to leaf since 1898. I'm appalled. I'm outraged. I congratulate the committee and the commission for their work. I look forward to visiting each of these trees, and I'm pleased to vote aye.
Hales.
Well, I want to thank both the volunteers who work on the Forestry Commission and the Heritage Tree Committee for their work, and our staff in Parks and Recreation for being good stewards of these trees. You know, Portland is a national success story and a great place to live for those of us who are smart enough to live here, in part because we have this amazing, diverse, growing urban forest. And this Heritage Tree Program, I think at least three of us here have had the privilege of going out and tacking up one of those little plaques. I did it with Jane Glazer many times when she was the chair of the commission. And I know Commissioner Saltzman and Fish have done so, and I bet Commissioner Novick, especially after that, those comments will be out there maybe at that particular tree doing the same thing. But it's a really important way that we popularize and explain why this matters and that we have this environment here that grows this amazing diversity of trees. I want to compliment the team and the Bureau on this really both handsome and user-friendly report, both the online version and the paper version. I think it's great that we document and, again, teach about what we're doing here. This is a really important part of Portland. I've been very involved in Friends of Trees, and I go to Friends of Trees plantings and issue a warning that says that planting trees might be habit-forming, and that you might develop the habit of working with your neighbors to do something constructive and therefore getting to know them better. You might develop the habit of believing that you personally can have something to do with the quality of the environment. And you might, and I would not recommend getting into a contest with Joe Paraski about this, but you might start walking down the street saying, look, a Quercus pincus or an Ulmus americana. But don't try that with him because he'll out-Latin us all. Thank you, Joe, for your service to this cause as well. Very happy to vote in favor of this. Aye. And then on the designation itself, please, roll call. We take a roll call on the second one.
That's a non-emergency. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's a non-emergency, so it passes to second reading. Thank you all very much for your work on this effort, and happy Arbor Month. That's amazing. Okay. Now let's move to the consent item that we pulled from consent.
Item 290, amend intergovernmental agreement with TriMet for support services related to the Portland Streetcar Loop project.
I believe we have staff here to walk us through this. Hi, Vicki, come on up.
For the record, I'm Vicki Deedy with the Bureau of Transportation, and I am the city's project manager for Portland Streetcar. Excuse me. The item before you today amends the intergovernmental agreement with TriMet for support services that they have provided to the city during the Portland Streetcar Loop project. I mean, as you know, the Portland Streetcar Loop project is the first streetcar project that has used federal funds, and that's not just locally, that's nationally. And interestingly enough, the federal rules, regulations, and the guidelines are still not in place from the Federal Transit Administration. So what this has really allowed the FTA to do is to be rather capricious in their interpretation of those rules, regulations, and guidelines. So TriMet has been an absolutely invaluable partner to the city as we've worked through the project by providing support and assistance to make sure that the city is in compliance with all the FTA requirements. What this amendment does is it anticipates and estimates the cost for TriMet to complete this work called for in the IGA. The main reason that there's an increase of $845,000 in compensation is that we are adding TriMet's training costs to the IGA, all of which are grant eligible. And all that means is that we can seek reimbursement against the project grant and the feds will participate. When streetcar gets operators, vehicle maintenance technicians, maintenance of way technicians, they come to us from TriMet pretty much fully trained, but the only thing we have to do is just familiarize them with our own system. So TriMet and the city agreed pretty early on in the project that we would wait until near the end of the project and assess the amount of total project contingency available to us before we committed adding any of the training costs to the IGA. So that's where we are today, and that's what this amendment does. The bottom line on it is that the action can be accomplished within the original budget that Council approved on October 28, 2009. I am more than happy to answer questions, and I'm sure there are some.
Let me make sure I understand what your explanation, Vicki, and that is to paraphrase it. So this isn't a cost overrun. This isn't an emergency patch job.
Nope.
This is an accounting transaction that makes sure that the federal government pays most of the cost of the training, and we waited to bill that cost until we knew that the money was there left over.
Absolutely.
At the end of the project. Okay.
Perfect.
Questions?
Mayor, I have a few if I could. And
mm-hmm.
First, Vicki, you do a terrific job explaining this to us. I thank you for that. And I have a first, I just want to make a plea, which is that in the when we put these items on the council agenda, I think we have a fairly formal policy that the dollar amount will be added. And I think one of the complications here was that the title of this matter somewhat obscures what we're taking up. And I think that is cured if we're just a little more transparent about the dollar amount.
Yeah, absolutely. We were informed of that yesterday, and all future ordinances and amendments will include that dollar amount.
I appreciate that, and there are many offenders in that rule, probably my office as well, so I'm not singling you out. I just would encourage that we do that. The other thing I just want to touch on is that this is you've been before us quite a bit in the last 6 months, and this council, I think, unanimously supported this project, and I don't sense any backing away of commitment for the success of Streetcar. But what we have had since we adopted or supported this project is we've seen significant delays. We've seen questions concerning the quality of the equipment that we've purchased. We've seen issues arise about frequency of service, and of course, we've all noticed that a number of the streetcars are running at, let's put it charitably, less than full occupancy. And I guess at some point it raises a question about what is the city's position vis-a-vis any deficiencies that have come up in dealing with third parties, like the manufacturer and others. And are we in fact doing everything we can to preserve our rights to seek full compensation for any damages that we may be eligible for because of things like delays or quality issues?
Yes, there is a section in the contract with Oregon Iron Works that talks about I've forgotten the name of the term.
Liquidated damages.
Thank you very much. Liquidated damages.
Of course.
And it's and we fully intend to use that particular section of the contract to our best advantage. It will give us some leverage as we move towards the end of that contract. I mean, and we won't determine until near the end of that contract how many of those days were acceptable delays and how many days were not, because Oregon Iron Works has the right to make the case to us one way or the other. So, yeah, we're perfectly aware of that, and we will protect and preserve that right.
Now, in addition, you know, the reason that I asked that this be pulled was I wanted to have a chance for a public airing of these issues and make sure that all of our questions were answered. And, Mayor, I appreciate that we did get a briefing from PBOT yesterday and answered virtually all the questions we had, and I thank you for that. And I'm also, frankly, encouraged by the commitment that we've received both from PBOT and the Mayor's office that when this project is complete, there'll be a top-to-bottom review of lessons learned.
Mm-hmm.
I have personal experience with doing things that are new and different, and the fact that we sometimes learn from those experiences. And I think this one is ripe for that kind of review, Mayor, because this has had some, frankly, unexpected twists and turns. And I think it would be good for us to have that top-to-bottom review and a report to council at some point in the future.
You bet.
Good.
And I would add that, you know, we really need to separate out the different kinds of contracts, the civil work and the track construction that was performed by Stacy Whitbeck was totally on time and totally on budget and no surprises. So it's really been the vehicle that has given us the biggest surprises in this whole loop project. And I would just remind council and ourselves that as we think about this, to remember that this is a new industry for Oregon Iron Works, and we are trying to help them facilitate building that industry within the state to provide good jobs, family wage jobs. So it has not been easy, but we slug our way through it.
And I certainly don't want to be a Monday morning quarterback on this. You know, we're, for example, in the housing area, we're now using modular housing more and more. And it's an industry in Oregon, and it's currently working out the kinks. So I understand that when we do something new and different, there's lessons to be learned. I just, on some level, I feel sorry for you because you often come to us with these kinds of issues. And at some point, we hope that it's functioning at the level that was anticipated, which is a loop that you can ride the entire loop in less than an hour. And the snafus about frequency and the performance of the cars and the bridge issues and all of that's worked out. And I think we'll all celebrate that day.
All of that's on our work plan, all of those issues.
So again, I appreciate the briefing we got.
You bet.
Other questions?
Concerns? So I just had a question. So TriMet will train the streetcar operators. And are those operators part of the rotated throughout the TriMet fleet? I mean, they're not just dedicated to streetcar.
They are dedicated to streetcar. Really? They come to us from TriMet as fully trained light rail operators.
Okay.
So the only thing that we have to do is just familiarize them with, you know, our particular cars, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a sign-up that occurs because their ATU, their union represents those employees, even while they work for us.
Okay, so they are dedicated streetcar operators then?
Yeah, they can go, they can bid, you know, someone else can outbid them or they can bid to go back.
Okay.
Last I heard, these are the most desired driver positions. So you're talking about the most elite operators at TriMet who are bidding to be on this assigned to streetcar.
We have a number of operators who have been there since we started, which was back in 2001. So. Yeah.
Other questions?
2001?
Yeah, I remember that day. Thank you very much, Vicki. Is there anyone else signed up on this item?
We didn't have a sign-up sheet.
Okay. What, you say you do?
We did not
we
have
did
a
not.
Sign-up
I'm
sheet.
I'm sorry. Okay. All right. Thank you, Vicki. Council. Sorry? Yeah? Anyone else want to testify? Sorry. There was not a sign-up sheet at all. I didn't hear you, Claire. Okay. All right. There's no one else to testify. Then let's take council roll call on the emergency ordinance.
Bish?
Well, I appreciate the testimony and the briefing we had this morning. And, Mayor, when I asked that this be pulled, I was prepared to vote no, not because I have lost confidence in general with streetcar, but I had more questions than answers. And since the briefing we received yesterday and the clarification that this is not about a cost overrun, that this, in fact, was anticipated, I feel more comfortable supporting this ordinance, coupled with the commitment that there'll be some lessons learned comprehensive review at the end so we can go back and see what we can learn. I believe it's important that we're transparent around these things, and these are complicated issues, and I think both in terms of the way they're packaged on our agenda and the discussions we have prior to council are very useful in helping make sure that all of the mayor's colleagues understand these issues and are comfortable with what's before us. I appreciate the time people took, and I vote aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Bish? Fritz?
Sorry. Thank you. I was late because I was in Salem testifying on earned sick leave. I'm glad I was here for this. And thank you, Commissioner Fish, for pulling it, and Mayor Hales for your explanation. I think it is important that people understand what has been done and, in fact, that things have been done appropriately. Thank you, Vicki, for your service. It's also important to remember that it wasn't expected that the East Side streetcar would be packed with passengers right off as soon as it started, that this is a development engine, it's a development tool, and the experience on the West Side was indeed build it and they will come. And so we're anticipating that it will stimulate development on the East Side, and that's an important part of this package. Aye.
Hales.
Well, Vicki, thank you. I think Vicki might succeed in escaping from city service before we do that final retrospective look at the streetcar project.
Yes, I might.
It's a race to see whether her impending retirement comes before that. But this is a success story and a history of innovation here in this community. You know, it was just 12 years ago, right, that we cut the ribbon on the first piece of the first American streetcar line in 50 years, and these are the first American-built streetcar vehicles. And that's a requirement when you take federal money, but it's also a risk, as Commissioner Fish has noted here, and the reason why we have to be vigilant and do careful oversight even while we're innovating. And I'll often quote Machiavelli, but he had a great quote about innovation, which I think has applied a couple of times to the streetcar, which is that there's nothing more difficult to plan or perilous to execute than the creation of a new system, because the innovator has all the enmity and opposition of those who will not benefit from the change, but only lukewarm support from all those who will benefit. And I think we see that whenever we build anything new. Well, that no one will ride light rail. There was a governor candidate, we may recall, who said that when East Side Light Rail was completed, we should just throw away the keys because no one would ride it. And I think the same kind of predictions were made about the streetcar. And once that loop is completed, I don't think we're going to have a problem with empty vehicles. I think we'll have a problem with probably not enough vehicles at some point, not too far from now. So just want to appreciate the work that you and Portland Streetcar Inc. are doing. And this council does have a very important oversight and financial management responsibility to make sure that the large amount of public funds that we're putting into this project are responsibly spent and that we get our money's worth from whoever we're buying things from. So we'll continue to exercise that oversight, and thanks for all your good work. Aye. Okay, regular agenda, item number 296.
Amend the Arts, Education, and Access Income Tax Code to add a definition for income-earning resident and include in the definition that a resident must have income of at least
$1,000 to be considered income earning.
Second reading, council roll call.
Fish?
We had a good and robust discussion about this last week, and I had the chance to state the reasons for why I intend to support this, and I appreciate the good work of the staff at the Bureau of Revenue for bringing this forward in a timely manner. Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Well, I'm glad we have the accompanying resolution that is going to take a holistic look at what would be a fair and equitable way to administer this tax. This is a good start. Aye.
Hales?
Thank you. Good work. Aye. Number 297.
Authorize an intergovernmental agreement with the State of Oregon Department of State Police to provide access to the automated biometric identification system.
I think we have someone from the Police Bureau here. There we go. To explain this item. Good morning.
I am George Babnick, captain of the Portland Police Forensic Division, and excuse me because I'm recovering from a respiratory infection.
I'm Chris. excuse me. I'm not suffering from a respiratory infection.
You will soon be recovering.
I'm Chris Wormdahl. I'm the ID technology coordinator for the Forensic Evidence Division.
So explain this rather unusual-looking item, because this is a continuation of an existing arrangement we have with the state for sharing information, but important for some public
correct.
Disclosure.
Correct. It does look a little – I might not talk too long and defer to Chris, but it's an IGA that would continue a longstanding agreement that we've had with the state police that allows the police bureau for criminal purposes to access the Western Identification Network, which currently has fingerprints and palm prints. It's the database that we use to run fingerprints through to that we discover at crime scenes, etc. Within the next year, the Western Identification Network plans to add a facial recognition feature that would be populated by mugshots taken from the seven Western states who are users of this or contributors to this system. And I think I'll defer to Chris now because I'm losing my voice.
Okay, thank you.
The anticipated addition of the facial recognition is only if county agencies include that with the fingerprint. So a mugshot has to be included with the fingerprint biometric. Same thing with the palm prints when that was added 6 years ago. That fingerprint, palm print had to be together. They can't be separate pieces. There is an additional piece of a iris, which is very new technology, is a possibility to be added in, and at this point there is no states that are known to be using that at this point.
Good, thank you. Questions? Yes, please.
So the ordinance says that the previous governmental agreement expired in June of 2011. What have we been doing since then?
We've been continuing on making payments to the state as our previous agreement while this was worked out.
So we have been continuing to use the system?
Yes, we have.
Without a contract being in place?
Correct.
And is the fee the same as it has been?
Actually, it's reduced. To give an abbreviated history of when Portland was one of the original organizations, member organizations, and we paid in as a state organization. We reduced it down to a local membership in, I think it was 2004. And since then, we have been paying a much more reduced cost. This current structure, and I think that we've been paying for the last 2 years, we had paid off the equipment costs, and now we're just paying for access to the system. So,
what are the criteria for someone's fingerprints being put into this system?
Well, as an arrested subject for the database, it is somebody who has been arrested and booked into Multnomah County Jail.
And if they've been found released or not tried or found not guilty, they're staying in the system?
By Oregon statute, the arrest is maintained, and their criminal history is maintained as an arrest event. If they go through an expunction or adult sealed record, then that record is removed from the system, as same as it is removed from their state criminal history record.
So would their fingerprints still be in the system in that
point? No, it would be removed.
And how do they, how does a person verify that their fingerprints are not in the system anymore?
Well, for